You are listening to the Zen Nova Scotia podcast with talks by Cone Franz. These talks are made possible in part by generous donations from our listeners. To find out how to support and take part in our community, visit zennovascotia.com.
There's a lot of talk in this tradition in particular about, and we even use the same phrase over and over, phrases, about seeing things as they are, or seeing reality as it is. I've used these phrases, I think, a lot, if you go back and listen. And I want to clarify a little bit about that for myself and for everyone. There's an understanding, I think, that we fall into when we hear this idea that we're going to see reality as it is, that the windshield is dirty, right? That if we just scrape off a layer of something, you know, like if my sink is really dirty, that if I just scrub it, then I'll see my sink as it is. There's some objective base version of the sink. And if I just get past all the muck, then I'll see it. And when I see it, I'll see the same sink that you would see if you did the same thing. Right? It's very pure. But we understand, you know, we're shrouded, there's delusion, and there's confusion, and there's some story that we're stuck on. This is how we talk about it. If we can just get rid of that, whoosh, then everything will seem as it should be. We'll finally see it in a true way. But that's not really how it works. I read two articles recently back to back, and I think sometimes when you already have a question in your mind, and then you go reading things or watching things, it feels as if everything is responding to your question. So I had this phenomenon. I read one article that was about virtual reality, and another that was about that article was by Joshua Rothman in The New Yorker. And then I also read an article by Tanisaro Bhikkhu, who is a Theravada monk. And he was talking about how the Buddha constructed the world. And I thought, oh, these two people are circling the same questions. This is really interesting. And I won't go into all of it, though it would be fun to talk in depth about both of these articles, which both got me really excited. But what they both come to in different ways, one from a scientific perspective and one from a very classical Buddhist perspective, is that everything we see is a product of our minds. All of it. Always. You can keep scrubbing the sink, but there's just sink all the way down. You'll never find that base level sink that is an objective truth. You cannot help but see it in the way that you see it. You're stuck. You're stuck in culture. You're stuck in language. You're stuck in experiences that you had that you don't even remember anymore, but which color everything for you. Tracy and I talk a lot about all the time that we spent in Japan, because we know some people who were visibly affected by living there for a long time. It made it difficult for them to live here. It's as if it broke something. And when we meet people who seem to fall into that category, sometimes we think, whew, boy, that guy, he got it bad. Right? But then we get honest with ourselves and we start thinking, well, what are the little ways in which that experience informs everything that we do? We can see some things. you know, that are more measurable. I think I've mentioned that I struggle with eye contact. After living for so many years in a place where you don't make eye contact, I force myself now to do it. It's conscious. It's something that kind of got taken away, and now I try to reclaim it, but it affects all of my interactions. But that's just one thing that I notice. We don't know all the things that make us us. We don't know all the things that color our view. But there is no version of us without those things, right? Even if we imagine for a moment that there is some objective truth, that there is some version of reality that is completely uncolored by the witnessing of it, and I think some quantum physics would say that doesn't work anyway, but let's imagine that it's there. You would have to be someone without culture, someone without language, someone without instinct, lest we fall into the idea that babies are enlightened or something, right? You would have to be a completely unformed brain with eyes to reach this enlightened state of seeing things as they objectively are. We know we don't want that. Whatever it is that this offers, it's not that. It's not the blank slate. So what is it? If we look carefully at the ways in which we seem to be constructing the world, if we start to acknowledge that construction of the world, it isn't just that we have, you know, regrets. Sometimes we talk about our story in these very narrative ways. I should have said that. Or I can't seem to let go of this. But it's also, look at the floor. Everyone sees something different in this floor. Every day I see something different in this floor. I'm one person. There's a witch's face that shows up in this floor, and sometimes it's a dog, because I sit here and I stare at it for a long time. All of you can do the same thing. It's like looking at clouds. It's not just our narrative about our lives. It's how we respond to anything, to any smell, to any color. It's all through this lens of me. And if I can start to recognize that process, if I can start to see that, if I can start to admit it, then Buddhism says there are kind of two ways to respond, and I think we can do both. The first, and in some ways I'm doing these in reverse order, but I'll do it. The first is to let go of this idea that there's a reality just beyond the reality you've constructed. That's not to say that you just submit and say, well, this is it, right? It's the opposite. It's you start to consciously stop believing yourself. When you have a strong reaction to something and you say, that's not true, then you start to think, is that true? That's not true? All the things that you think must be real, all the things that you think must be right or must be wrong, you start to not necessarily interrogate all of them. You start to give them a little more space to breathe. You start to recognize that what you're seeing is a reflection of yourself. When you do that, you start to understand that that's what everyone is doing. Right? And you let go of the fantasy that when someone disagrees with you, it's because their view is obscured. while you see things very clearly. This can be almost like a mantra, right? Where you just constantly ask yourself, really? Really? All of this not so that you eventually get to some truth, but so that you reach a place that's honest. Right? Seeing reality is as it is not some objective thing. It's understanding the process by which you see. It's a letting go. And that's one. But the other one, and this is what Tanisaro was talking about, and this explains a lot of Buddhism. By the way, Buddhism also, right? It's not objectively there. If we are constructing a worldview all the time, if we recognize that we're constructing a worldview all the time, if we're starting to question that worldview all the time, then we can also start to choose a worldview moment to moment. There are skillful ones and unskillful ones. There are ones that seem to offer benefit and those that seem not to. And like I just said, Buddhism is one. Buddhism is a fabrication of the mind. But many of us have come to the conclusion that it's a fairly useful one. It's useful to imagine that there's this thing called Buddhism. Right? It's useful to imagine that there's this thing called Zen. And then to go a step further and to imagine that what these things are saying is true. And then to act on them. There are so many, I'll give you one example because it's a favorite. There's a popular teaching, not in Zen, that every single person you meet was once your mother. There are very few ideas more beautiful than this, in my mind. If I stop and think about this for just a few seconds, it starts to kind of crack me open. Because if there's anyone in my vicinity, if there's anyone walking down the street, if there's anyone in another car, I look at them and I think, oh, within that story, that person, all of these people, once loved me so much, even if they don't remember it, even if I don't remember it, they cared for me, they held me, they fed me, they protected me. I have such a debt to this person. I felt so safe with this person. I feel, and because I felt so safe then, I can feel gratitude now. It's poetic. It's a gorgeous idea. And so I would argue that this is a skillful worldview. It's useful. Because if you believe this, it makes you more vulnerable. And when you become more vulnerable, you become more gentle and kind. And when you become more gentle and kind, people benefit. When my son was a little bit younger, and we would talk about superheroes, and he wanted to know about the good guys, and he wanted to know about the bad guys. And I would always tell him, the way parents do, I would say, the bad guys never win. Good guys win. Even if it looks like the bad guy won, in truth, really, really, bad guys don't win. And I said that because I think it's a useful thing to plant in his mind. It's not because it's objectively true. It's because I think that there's a skillfulness, there's a benefit that comes from believing that it's true. Maybe especially when you're young. I don't think I'm lying to my son. But I'm being very intentional about the narrative that I offer. But here's the thing, and here's where I think it gets really juicy and really interesting. And here I'm speaking specifically from this tradition again. In order to be skillful, in order to offer benefit, you can take up a particular view. You can embrace it. You can hold it moment to moment, and you can cultivate that view. You can take active steps to deepen that view. But you have to do this without falling into the trap of believing that it's true. That takes a particular level of sophistication, or what I usually call maturity. Can you look at everyone you meet as if that person was once your mother without believing it? I'm not saying disbelieve it. I'm saying don't believe it. Don't let it become a part of your story that is unconsidered, because we have to do both of these things at the same time. Part one, to recognize that everything we see is fabricated. And two, to choose certain ways of seeing that are fabricated. To hold that is really at the heart of how this practice works. Especially when we get into the more formal aspects, things like the bowing and the chanting, right? Where the tradition is asking us to commit to something, to invest in this act of placing our foreheads on the ground, or in this act of saying these ancient words. Can you do it without allowing it to become a story that's unconsidered? Can you do it without allowing it to become something that gives you a false sense of safety or a false sense of what's real? Can you commit to it while thoroughly not knowing what you are doing? Because again, we never know what we're doing. It's just that we can take up the challenge of thoroughly not knowing what we're doing. In everything from relationships to how we get dressed. I love this aspect of the practice. I say this aspect, it's kind of the whole thing, but this tension for me has always felt very alive. Always. And there have been moments when I have believed nothing. And there have been moments when I have believed something and it's been like a teddy bear. It's felt so good to believe that thing. But the place where it really hums is somewhere in between those two. Where I have one in one hand and one in the other. Zen is really fun. And I'll stop there.
For more information about Zen, our practice, and how you can support and take part in our community, please visit zennovascotia.com.